Birth, the Grand Division, Chapter 29. "Good morning, Boris," said Marina as she leaned forward with a straight back in her office chair. "You can take your bicycle through the door. Franz will show you where to put it." The door from the small lobby of this suite in building H4 buzzed quietly as Franz opened from the inside. "This way, Boris," he said. He rolled the bicycle down the hall and through another secure door into the main assembly floor. He remembered being in this building when it was used to build rocket sections, the smell of titanium spars being machined and the huge jig that once was bolted to the floor here was still lingering in the air. The few windows that had been broken and the glass skylights overhead had been replaced with metal panels, making it slightly darker than he recalled. But it was still a marvelous facility. He looked up onto the second-floor mezzanine that once was painted to perfection with yellow handrails and bright orange beams that held the overhead crane, were now dull and covered in a thin layer of dust. The cables were the color of rust, and there were spiderwebs hanging off the electrical rails for the crane. He remembered 200 people working in here. It was one of the proudest moments in his life when he funded the building of this facility. "You can leave your bike here," said Franz, pointing to an open tool locker surrounded by a wire grate. "No one will bother it." "Give me a second to take my jacket off," said Boris, hanging his riding jacket on the bike over the seat and leaning it against the inside of the cage. "Let me show you something," said Franz. Boris followed him down a hallway off the front side of the main assembly room. There were thick double doors on oversized hinges that resembled a safe, except the doors were filled with lead. The room was used to store warheads in the old days of the Energy Bureau, but they never had any inventory. It was a ruse. The line items made the American CIA think this was a missile factory, when in fact it was purely used for space research. The strategy was to get the Americans to spend more money to keep up with something that did not exist. They ended up being tricked by the same idea, and the Soviet Empire collapsed as a result. "That's what happens when you play cards with the banker," said Boris at the time. "Here you go, Franz." "These look like stainless steel whirlpool tubs," said Boris. He was confused. This was sporting equipment used in the high-end gymnasiums for Olympic and professional athletes. The workmanship was impeccable. The shaped stainless steel plates were smooth without flaw, and the welds were invisibly made with the finest workmanship. "Oh, they are, and much more," said Franz. "Please, come around here." Boris walked around to the exquisitely fitted motor control center with a programmable display. "The temperature can be lowered to nearly freezing and raised to 42 degrees Celsius without ice. The water can be infused with minerals to relieve pain, apply hormones and steroids, and can be sterilized, unlike the fiberglass competition," said Franz with pride. "But I was sure that..." Boris could not complete the sentence. "Patience," said Franz, as he used his cylinder key to open the large control panel door. The door revealed a shallow back panel, loaded with relays, heaters, cable trays, and a variety of power supplies and timers. He reached up toward the rear and rotated the two cam locks and grabbed the post for the main power switch and pulled. The back panel swung open, revealing a slide carriage and frame with lead panels on five sides. The shiny lid was removed, but it was clear that this was designed to hold something radioactive. "The water absorbs any alpha particles that might come through the lead, making this invisible from satellite surveillance once it is in place. The lead plating is polished to a bright finish and then coated with clear polyurethane, giving it the appearance of stainless steel," said Franz. "A standard warhead should fit in there nicely," said Boris, satisfied that he had been right all along. "Fully loaded, these weigh about 1,000 kilos, said Franz. "Fooled me," said Boris. "Not too well," said Franz. I took a chance, said Boris. The Saudis are lazy and have half the world's money. They like to live long and healthy lives, although they never exercise except for week-long sex parties with their concubines. These machines make up the state-of-the-art in life extension technology. Everything from pure testosterone to liquid Viagra can be infused with this technology without ever piercing the skin. They have ordered four of them, two for the VIP suites newly constructed at Mecca, and the same in Medina. It's a spiritual experience, said Franz. Well, let's give them a truly spiritual transition, said Boris with a smooth chill to his voice. Well, yes, that is a challenge, isn't it? Asked Franz. This building has enough of a latent radiation signature that no one is going to see your warheads here, said Boris. The warheads have left Irwin, Tennessee, and they are on their way to two different ports. The triggers are coming from Germany. The tritium tank is held up in Savannah, waiting customs, said Franz. We should have two more warheads, and we should divide them up between six ports. That way, if one or two are discovered, you still end up with your payloads. Forget about the tritium in Savannah. Let it get discovered. That way the ATFE idiots will feel like they have stopped an incoming shipment and thwarted a terrorist plot. Even if they don't believe it, they could use the publicity. I have some resources I can bring to bear, said Boris as he stood up from his view of the inside of the high-tech whirlpool. Do you need any money? Asked Franz. I have some money coming in. Don't open any accounts on my behalf. It wouldn't look right. I'll let you know if I need anything, said Boris. What about your friends in the no-go zone? Asked Franz. We'll see how faithful they are when their silly god dies, said Boris with a straight smile. Franz breathed out with a chuckle and patted Boris on the back. Welcome aboard, Mr. Domashev. Is there somewhere where I can sit down and access the web? Asked Boris. Not in this building, said Franz. We're dark for a reason. It's nice to be home, said Boris. There is a coffee shop, said Franz. I know the place, said Boris. I was just thinking I needed a cup. You can show me the ports. Can you secure two more warheads? Even demilitarized units would work fine. Marina can fix you up, said Franz. I'll be back in a couple of hours, said Boris. Franz smiled and shook his hand firmly and closed the inner panel while Boris walked back to Marina's front desk. Marina was truly a stunning creature. Her long, jet-black hair was perfect, without a hair out of place. Her eyes were wide-set and large, made even larger by absolutely flawless makeup with the right colors to make them appear even larger and bluer. Her teeth were so straight and white that no man could take his eyes off them as she talked. The skin on her bare arms had no marks or blemishes of any kind. Her alabaster color was magnificent when contrasted with her perfect sense of fashion. Everything about her said female, and yet the feeling you got after just a few minutes was deadly. Do you like our product? She asked in perfect Russian. Da, said Boris with the greatest effort to look at her. I gather there is some interest in making sure we can deliver them to their destinations, she said again in perfect Russian. I have a long relationship with many Saudi shipping merchants, said Boris. They will be happy to help deliver such a fine product. The technology is very powerful, you know. The treatments we can provide can restore someone to their perfect appearance, she said in English. I'm sure the royals will enjoy the benefits, he said, smiling slightly. I trust you, Boris. I did the moment I met you, she said without moving anything on her face but her mouth. I find that interesting, said Boris in Russian, using the bureaucratic skills he had mastered. I think you doubt me, she said with a hint of a smile and in the smoothest Russian he had ever heard. That will change, I think. I have to go make some calls, but I think I need to know the shipper, the point of origin, and I need your import papers, he said without hesitation. Marina opened a drawer and pulled a file folder out with the required documents. "They're Panamanian," she said. "I'm sure they are," he said, taking them without looking at them. "I'll be back in a couple of hours." Boris placed the papers down on the table next to Marina's desk and took photos of each one. He stacked them together and handed them back to her. He held his cell phone up to her and rocked it back and forth in his hand. "Encrypted to 6 digits with a self-destruct if stolen," he said. "Standard issue for FedEx?" she asked. "Of course," he said with a smile. "Do you need any money?" she said, holding out a small bundle of cash for him. "Thank you. I may have a cake with my coffee after all," he said, pocketing the money. With that, Boris walked back to the tool cage and got his bicycle and returned to the exit through the lobby without another word. He could feel that Marina never took her eyes off him, and yet he could not bring himself to look at her. Until just as he was ready to pull his bike through the doorway to the parking lot, his glance back was measured and cool, and when he met her eyes, it took every bit of his strength not to show a change in his expression. "So dangerous," he thought. With the exception of the gaping hole in his heart, he felt somewhat alive again. He watched the alleys and corners for cars that might be watching, but there were none. Whoever these people were working for, they had attracted no attention from anyone in the energy underworld. As he pedaled and began to breathe harder, he didn't know whether to feel relieved that this was the case or terribly afraid there was a group with such power that was somehow sanctioned by powers higher than governments. He focused on the job at hand and tried to arrange things in order, like the old days. He arrived at the Starbucks coffee shop and placed the front wheel of his bike into the rack. He took off his jacket in the cool Kazakh morning to let his build-up body heat escape. He could feel the welcome coolness pass through the fabric of the black shirt he was wearing and figured he wouldn't sweat if he just waited a moment before going inside. He took a few long, deep breaths and walked through the door. "Good morning. May I have a 20 mocha latte and a blueberry scone, please?" he ordered and paid for the order with cash. "Mind if I use your internet at one of your outside tables?" receiving a smile and a nod. In a few minutes the mocha was piping hot and in his hand. "Thank you," he said. It didn't take long to set up an anonymous VPN at Starbucks, and without anyone else there, the speed was acceptable. He entered the shipper and the waybill, making sure the approvals didn't throw any flags. Power supplies. Clever, he said to himself. He already knew there were 384 inactive W-84 cruise missile warheads. They were 13 inches in diameter and just 34 inches long at about 388 pounds each, and had a small fissile trigger that would have been removed. That was probably a good thing, as the housing is titanium and would not shield the gamma signature emitted by the enriched uranium wrapped in plastic explosive used as the trigger. The new German triggers were superior to the old American ones and would be made to fit snugly inside the W-84 casing. They would also need a full load of tritium injected into the stainless steel cylinders inside and pressurized to 4,000 pounds per square inch to get them to their 150 kiloton yield and back to active status. The Soviet Union conducted 715 tests involving 969 devices by official count, most at Semipalatinsk test site and Novaya Zemlya, and a few more at various sites in Russia, Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, and Ukraine. Boris was well aware of the performance and safety precautions associated with handling and deploying a nuclear warhead of this size. He checked the container ships flying the Panamanian banner. Although these ships carry everything from drugs to small arms, the label is familiar to all ships at sea. Panama is the heart and soul of illegal money laundering. Hiding money is their most lucrative industry. Practically everyone with an account there is an enemy of other account holders. but it is the Panamanian banner that gives them the ability to move oppression and genocide around the planet with impunity. Everything was in order. No one would be looking for four separate shipping containers filled with oil field service equipment and Caterpillar replacement engines. The packaging said they were packed in 55-gallon drums of 90-weight gear lube oil. No alpha particles were getting out of that. He closed down the shipper's page and sent a text to his old comrade in Jeddah. Getting them into Kazakhstan might not be that much of an issue, but getting them into Saudi Arabia and to the two holiest cities of Islam might be a challenge. He needed help with a shipper that was trusted by the royals. These whirlpools were being sold as the Fountain of Youth, and that is something they would guard jealously. In Saudi Arabia, everything is for sale, especially if it belongs to someone else. It always seemed a bad idea to Boris to risk having one's hands cut off in the public square for the chance at a few dollars selling something that didn't belong to you. But there seemed to be a line around the block to do just that. Within seconds, the text came back in the blue bubble, fully encrypted. It was the right response. The Moore container ship would arrive at the dock and be offloaded. The containers would be transported by truck to Mecca and stripped from their container near Al-Mursalat in the industrial complex. The crates would be first class and would likely not be taken apart until the units could be put in place in the royal suite between the two clock towers overlooking the Hajj and the Black Cube. The second target was Al-Masjid al-Nabawi, also known as the Prophet's Mosque in Medina. It was Muhammad's destination after his hijrah from Mecca and served as the power base of Islam in its first century, where the early Muslim community developed into the bloodthirsty religion it is today. The trucks would have to travel a little further, but if he gave them a police escort, the truck would deliver without issue to the royal quarters near the mosque. He knew the Americans would suspect that these cities were going to be destroyed by nuclear attack. He had to. He calculated that they would not know how the weapons would be delivered. They would be searching for them with aerial drones and satellites, but there was a chance that the skies would be clear during the Hajj. There would be millions of Muslims from all over the world in the two cities during that time. Mostly, they hate America, so they would never tolerate drones being in the air during that holy time, because they don't trust anyone. Because Saudi Arabia is the seat of power for Islam, no other Muslim state would attack them for fear of bringing down the revenge of Allah on their heads. Besides, the House of Saud funded most of the serious terrorist activity around the world and paid for nearly all the mosques built in Europe and America. His quick search also revealed that at that point, jihadists had killed more than 30,000 people since the attack on the World Trade Centers in September of 2001. There was no love lost for jihadis around the world. He breathed deeply and relaxed with his mocha as he finished his blueberry scone. He felt at peace and that he could make the arrangements for getting the whirlpools into place. His mind began working on the decoys. They would come from Oak Ridge and be without a plutonium core. The uranium trigger would be in place along with the plastic explosive, forming a powerful cowl of implosive force to crush the uranium to criticality. Even dogs could smell that if the outer case was opened. He thumbed through the ports where he had connections. He could get them to the south, to the ports in Florida, but they might actually escape the country if he did that. He concentrated on the northeast, close to the command and control. This would make them more diligent in finding them, and victoriously lazy once they are found. Within a few minutes, he decided to ride back to Oscar's house. He still had a little over an hour, and he knew someone would be watching his every move. He swung his leg over the bike and left his jacket partially unzipped as the morning was warming up. He rode across town to the edge where Oscar's farmhouse had become part of the city. Oscar was still at work, but he knew his wife would still be there. He parked the bike on the porch and tried the front door, which was open, and walked in. "Hello," he said as he closed the door behind him. "Oh, hello, Boris," came the reply from the kitchen area. "How was your first day at work going?" "At work? Oh, well, it was just the interview. I'm going back for the rest in half an hour or so," he said. "Would you like some coffee? I can make some," she said as she turned toward the kitchen, anxious to please. "No, no, that's all right. I just had a cup and a scone. I'm fine. I'll be in my room for a few minutes, and then I must return to the factory." "Okay. I'm going back to my radio program, then. Have a wonderful day," she said. He climbed the stairs and took off his jacket as he entered his little room. The safe was sitting on the dresser. He spun the combination and opened the door. He withdrew his wedding picture of him and Sasha and looked at it. He took a deep breath and let it out slowly. He was at peace because he knew he had given her a good life. He was full of love for her as he placed the gilded frame back into the fireproof box. He withdrew the cash Marina had given him and counted it, surprised to find it Saudi rial, Chinese yuan, and rubles equivalent to $1,000 U.S. "Pocket change," he said softly. He withdrew a zippered bag from the safe and opened it. Inside was nearly $20,000 in American and Russian money. He took all the money Marina had given him, except the rubles, added it to the bag, and zippered it closed. With his bereavement, he should be able to do everything he needed to do. He tilted his head to the side as he considered the future. He reached in the safe and palmed the Walther PPK and pulled the clip to make sure it was loaded. He checked the slide for one in the chamber, was satisfied that it was clear, and put it into his pocket. He shuffled down the stairs and headed for the front door. "I'm headed back to work," he said, raising his voice to the kitchen. "Okay, Boris, have a great day," she said without getting up from the kitchen table where she sat listening to the radio. Within a few minutes, he was pedaling back toward Building H4. It was going to be an interesting day.